Welcome back to the AstroCast. I'm your host, Rue. Today is Tuesday, March 5th, 2024, and we are approaching new moon. It is officially spring, meteorologically speaking, not astronomically speaking. We have not quite reached the vernal equinox, but it is fast approaching right around the corner. Orion is well past the meridian in my particular corner of the world after sundown. And, you know, we finally got a clear night last night. Actually had a friend over and, we set up my wide field scope out front and got to kick back for a couple of hours and just look back at the stars, which is one of my all time favorite pastimes as well as his. This is the same friend that is going to be joining me on our dark sky trip in June, which I am very much looking forward to. So I was messing around with my wide field rig last night, which is my Rokinon 135, along with my ASI 294mm Pro, which is a really capable camera that I generally use with my SV Boney 80ED on my CEM 26. And one of the reasons that I'm starting to strongly consider getting that new ASI 585 MC Pro, which is their new budget-friendly cooled camera that they very recently released, is because I seem to run into a lot of trouble swapping that camera between those two rigs as far as tilt issues and swapping filters out. I don't have a filter wheel on either of those two rigs, so that's a little bit of a pain. Getting things wired up and balanced properly is a little bit of a pain. Generally for me, you know, I just open my garage door, pick up my rig and walk it outside and it's, you know, quick and easy and I can be set up and running in a matter of 5 minutes. But if I've got to, you know, swap out cameras and lenses and things like that, it can add to my setup time exponentially, which can be a little bit of a pain. So that's got me thinking about that new 585 MC Pro quite a bit, especially considering we have this dark sky trip coming up. I would love to be able to have both my 80 millimeter refractor as well as the Rokinon 135 running at the same time all night long. And then also have my Canon R7 with, you know, either like one of the two fisheye lenses that I spoke about in the last episode, the 11 millimeter or the 7.5 millimeter lens, doing a, you know, wide field Milky Way shot all night long. So basically, you know, three rigs for all intents and purposes. I'd have the Skyguider Pro with the R7 and then the other two rigs running. So anyway, last night we were sitting out in the driveway and I had the two rigs running and we were talking about the upcoming trip and having a, you know, really good time. The seeing was initially really poor and we were talking about just how irritating it is that, you know, the night sky just continues to get brighter and brighter. And I actually commented that, like, acclimating your eyes to the night sky in a Bortle 6 borderline 7 area it's nearly pointless because when you look up at the sky, it's just so bright that it's almost like, what more is there to reveal? Because you can see such a big glow on the night sky that there's just not too much more depth to reveal. Now, that's not to say that your eyes shouldn't adjust at all. Of course, you should do some adjustment and, you know, bright car lights and things like that are definitely going to impact your ability to see the stars. But man, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have like a national dark sky holiday or maybe like one day or 2 days a year where it's new moon and we have clear skies, we could just somehow convince everyone to turn their lights off for just one night. I mean, I feel like if you could, and I know I'm speaking like completely in dream la la land here, but if you could somehow convince the entire population of North America and Europe, Asia, Europe, did I already say Europe? If you could convince the entire world at new moon to turn off their lights for one night, I would be willing to bet you that they would do it several times per year at new moon. because people don't know what they're missing with dark skies. I feel like so many people have grown up in areas that are so bright that they just, you know, they don't know what they're missing. It's so bright all the time that they only see a few stars in the night sky. And if you've never been out to a truly dark location, which unfortunately, you know, 80, 90% of the population probably hasn't, they just don't know. So, you know, if you've never seen the Milky Way, you really can't understand its majesty and all of its, you know, glory, frankly, if you haven't seen it. So, you know, in my dream world, we would somehow convince the politicians and the powers that be to just cut off all the lights for one night, you know, give it a test run for one night around new moon and just, you know, see how the people react. So as the night went on, we did notice it got a little bit darker up towards the zenith. We did notice a significantly darker area, which was nice. We actually saw a really good shooting star. It was beautiful. It went right overhead. So like pretty much right at the zenith, maybe slightly more to the north. But it was a really brilliant blue and it left behind a really bright smoke tail, which was just beautiful. And my buddy commented that was the best one that he'd seen in a long time. I think it was the best one that I had seen since the one that I saw last summer at the observatory that lit up the sides of the buildings, which was probably the brightest one I've ever seen in my life. But it was a really, really good meteor, which was super cool to see. Outside of that, we sat out and we watched Orion slowly creep into the trees. The Pleiades were nearly behind the trees when he arrived, and the Hyades were, closely following behind along with Orion. Sirius was right at the meridian. And as time went on, we saw Leo start coming, you know, marching right into center stage there. And, just looking south right now, Leo is starting to come front and center. If you're outside at, 10, 11 o'clock at night, you'll see Leo is starting to take center stage, which can only mean one thing in the Northern Hemisphere. And that is galaxy season is right around the corner. So we're going to talk about a few things with galaxy season today. I want to talk about some cool targets that are in the area, along with one that I actually worked on imaging last night. We had a lot of fun. I think galaxy season, outside of the obvious, as far as I talked about a couple weeks ago on the Seasons of Astronomy episode, you know, having a small refractor, as many of us do that are new to astrophotography, and maybe they don't have giant scopes with really long focal lengths and those sorts of things. It's an excellent time to do electronically assisted astronomy, so EAA for short. And this is basically live stacking of images over and over and over again to reveal more and more detail as you sit there. And this is actually what me and my buddy did last night, because I wanted to see if we could get a comet to appear. So there was a comet, 67P Suchinen, and forgive me if I mispronounced that. I actually mentioned it at the end of last week's episode. It's over in the area of Markarian's chain right now at night, and it's fairly dim. I think it's around like magnitude 10, if I'm not mistaken, and it's a green comet. And it was funny because when I searched for it in the ASI air, it was saying that it was over by the Pleiades. And I was like, that can't be right, because I had looked in Stellarium earlier in the day, and I had even sent my friend who was there with me a photo earlier showing him the coordinates. And I was like, do you still have that photo I sent you? I was like, can you pull that up? And I checked the RA and the declination. And sure enough, I was, right in that area of Markarian's chain, like, 12 hours, 20 minutes, right ascension, something around there. And sure enough, the ASI air had it wrong. So they probably need to work on that. That being said, it did pop up with saying I needed an update whenever I initially turned it on. So perhaps they have already corrected that and I just need to install that latest update. I'll make sure I do that before I get into the next session, you know, go ahead and update the software. But we got on there and I initially started to image it with, you know, 60 second exposures. And then I stopped for a second because I couldn't really see anything on the first exposure. And I was like, you know, we're just hanging out tonight. And I don't think I'm going to try to turn this into a print or like an incredible photo that I'm going to try to share on Instagram or anything, just because it's really tiny galaxies and it's not the kind of thing that's going to be visually pleasing to the eye. So why don't we just see if we can really capture this comet in real time and actually identify it, you know, using our eyes while we're actually sitting here talking. We weren't in a hurry, so we had a couple hours, you know, we're hanging out, talking and catching up because we hadn't seen each other in a few months. So that's what we did. We sat down and I couldn't see the comet initially on the first few exposures at all. And I knew I was in the right area. I double checked in Stellarium Mobile to make sure that that's where it was. And, you know, just put Mark Herron's chain in the same area on my ASI Air, and then I started with 30 second live stacks. So basically set that down, put my phone in my pocket, and then we started talking and, you know, we were just kind of shooting the breeze for a while. And about half an hour later, I pulled my phone out and we started looking and we could see, you know, quite a few objects coming through. Unfortunately, when I hit annotate on the image, the ASI Air left a lot to be desired. It told us quite a few objects, like basically all the big Messier objects, but it didn't tell us like the eyes. It didn't specifically say Mark Herron's chain, other things like that. I don't know if maybe it would have done that if I was using my longer focal length scope, but I was really hoping it would nail, you know, all of the galaxies that are in that area, because there are a lot of them, especially at 135 millimeter focal length. But anyway, I'm looking around the photo and I'm looking in the area where I think it is, and I'm not seeing it. And then I scroll a little bit up in the photo, and sure enough, there is a green blob right there in the upper center portion of the photo to the right of Mark Herron's chain. We had resolved the comet. So it was just a super cool feeling. We both saw it and it was just awesome. It was super, super cool to know that we had captured a comet just while we were sitting there talking and were able to actually see it with our own two eyes. And that's something that electronically assisted astronomy can do for you, that, you know, looking through an eyepiece of a telescope might not be able to do for you, particularly with really dim objects like a magnitude 10 comet. You know what I mean? You might not be able to see that from a Bortle 7, you know, backyard with a, you know, 127 millimeter Newtonian scope or whatever the typical size, you know, backyard scope is. So, you know, something to consider if you have an ASI Air, they're extremely popular these days. Perhaps you might consider, doing a little bit of EAA this galaxy season and just trying to see what you can see. There's a lot to be seen out there. So one more time, that comet is a 62P Sunchanan. And forgive me if I'm botching the name of that one, particularly if you are the person who discovered it. I'm sorry, I'm terrible at pronouncing names, but 62P, if you look it up in the catalog, you should be able to find it. It should be in the area of Mark Herron's chain for a good little bit here. You know, perfect for new moon around this month. So definitely have a look at that if you want to find something cool. Other notable comets, obviously, would be 12P, which is Pons Brook. I've been seeing a lot of this comet on all of the Facebook astronomy and astrophotography pages. Quite a few awesome shots I have seen of this one, a few that were really incredible in particular. Apparently, it has very, very little relative motion in comparison to the typical sidereal motion, which is, you know, the rotation of our night sky in comparison with the stars. A lot of times, comets, when they get into their orbits, they will be moving much faster or slower relative to the stars and the night sky from our point of view. And that can make it really tricky for astrophotographers to take long exposure images of them, because the stars will trail if they are taking a long exposure of the comet, or the comet will not look good if they just try to take long exposures of the stars. So apparently this one has been called something of an astrophotographer's dream because it matches up so well with the speed, if you will, of our stars. And therefore you can just do single long exposures and not have to worry about correcting for, a different speed on the comet itself. Now, that being said, it is pretty low on the horizon right now, just after sundown. I believe it's around 30 degrees right now. It's in the northwest, if you're in the northern hemisphere, the northwest horizon, left of Polaris, obviously, and 30 degrees. You would probably want to be, if you can, up high. You definitely wouldn't want any trees in the way. The shots that I have seen have mostly not had trees in the way. I think I've seen a few with some trees to the right of the comet. But I would think if you're going to be doing any, 60-second or longer exposures, you're not going to want any trees, especially if you want to stack them for as long as you can before it gets too low to where you can't get any more. Those trees are going to quickly become a problem. So definitely check that one out if you get a chance. Unfortunately, from my perch here in Charlotte, I am not able to get 12P. There's just a bunch of trees in that particular part of the sky. One of my neighbors last week was actually chopping down trees in his front yard. And boy, he went to town. He was taking out a lot of trees. And I started to get really excited because I was looking and I saw if he just took out two more that he was going to reveal about 15 more degrees of sky for me in the northeast portion of the sky. And I'm like, oh, man, please take out those two more. But unfortunately, my excitement was for naught. He did not take out those last two trees. So that same bit of sky is still blocked, unfortunately. So yeah, Pons Brooks, very cool comet, definitely worth checking out in the near future if you get a chance to before it disappears. I want to say it's like mid-April when it's going to be out of sight. It's already pretty low on the horizon once, darkness rolls around, so you don't have too much longer to find it. I need to check in Stellarium and see exactly how much longer we have, but you don't got too much longer. So if you want to have a look at Pons Brooks, definitely do that. And then 67P, that should be up there for a good bit. That one's very, very dim, though, compared to Pons Brooks. So don't expect that one to be, quite as breathtaking. You definitely won't pick that up with a single, 60-second image, but you can definitely see it. And that's a good target for something like EAA. So definitely check that out. So I was talking to a friend of mine named Ryder. He is from Australia. He is in a little town called Nihil, I believe is how you pronounce it. Forgive me, Ryder, if I said your town name wrong. And we were discussing his possible purchase of some Bortle 1 land in the near future. So he is apparently in negotiations to purchase a pretty large chunk of Bortle 1 land that is between two national parks in the darkest of dark skies that you'll ever see. He sent me some photos and a video last night, actually, as me and my buddy were sitting outside looking at the stars, and I was just blown away by the sky that he's got out there. So a low horizon on all 360 degrees. So just a perfect view of the sky. If he did need to cut down any trees, he certainly could, but it didn't look like there were any that would significantly block out any portion of the sky. So he doesn't got anything to worry about that. It's well outside of the only town, which is, I believe, only a Bortle 1 or something. Like it's already barely anything. I believe he did say it's a Bortle 1 or maybe it was a Bortle 2. Either way, the only town that's nearby is like 350 kilometers away from the nearest major city, which is Melbourne, Australia. So it's out in the middle of nowhere in Australia in the southern hemisphere. And I really hope he's able to purchase that land. He has put together some of the most incredible work. He's actually one of the people that first inspired me to get into astrophotography. I found him early on when I very first started, and I actually messaged him because I think I had a question about one of the photos that he took, and we've stayed in touch ever since. And, you know, he'll tell me about his rigs and I'll tell him about, you know, what I'm working on, et cetera, et cetera. And we just happened to catch up last night, and he actually told me that if he is able to land this purchase, that we would be welcome to come out to Australia to visit him, which for me would be like a, you know, a lifetime bucket list type dream to be able to go out and see southern skies under Border One conditions. So, you know, really hoping that that deal ends up working out for you, Ryder. Obviously, that would be incredible. His plan, I believe, is to open up kind of what he describes as a low-tech astronomy club, where other people, you know, he can host star parties and, you know, bring the kids out to look through telescopes and see the stars and those sorts of things. That's nothing new to him. In fact, he also sells his work. His name is Knight Rider. I believe he's got a website too. If I can find his website, I'll actually link it in the show notes. I'm probably betting against myself here because I also sell my work, but me and him do really different kind of work. He does a lot of really awesome wide frame Milky Way shots. Not that he doesn't do really great deep field stuff as well, because he does. But anyway, I'll link to his work in the show notes, and just really hoping that he's able to close that deal out, because that land looks incredible. I think, you know, for me, it's, you know, such a dream to be able to have my own piece of Border One land. And in Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, that is not possible. The best that I could hope for would be to have a, you know, a pad at my local astronomy club, which is a Border Four. That is by no means bad. It's, you know, pretty great, all things considered. You can see the Milky Way, and it's, you know, it's very dark compared to how it is in my neighborhood. But it just doesn't compare to a Border One sky. So if you ever get a chance to go to a Border One sky, I highly recommend that you do that. I don't know what the elevation is at that land. I've heard people say that, you know, like out west in North America, for example, if you can get into the higher elevation, like up in the mountains, obviously that cuts down on the atmosphere and you can get a much brighter view of the stars in a Border One zone being up much higher. For me, at my dark sky site that I go to, it's much closer to sea level. So I get Border One skies once a year, you know, when I make my dark sky trip, but they're not high elevation. So that's something that I have still yet to see. I hope to do it one day. I've thought about going to the Okitex star party that they do every year. I think they do that in the late summer, if I'm not mistaken. Let me check real quick. Okay, so yeah, the Okitex Star Party will be taking place this year, September 27th through October 5th, 2024. And that is, I believe it's right near the border of Oklahoma and Texas, hence the name. It's at Camp Billy Joe, and they actually are at 4,439 feet. And it is indeed a Border One site. So they definitely have some incredible skies out there. That's one of my dreams, is to be able to attend that star party. And that goes for, you know, over a solid week. I've watched videos from the Okitex star party. I know that Astro Backyard, you know, Trevor from Astro Backyard has attended that star party and, you know, brought back some incredible video from it and some incredible photos as well. So I think that would be an absolute blast to do. That started as a Texas star party way back in 1984 and has just grown to bigger and bigger proportions ever since. And now it's, I think it's pretty much the biggest one in North America. This is the 41st annual party that they're having this coming year. Now, unfortunately, I will not be able to attend this year because me and my wife are planning on taking our first vacation. And I believe it's been about 3 years since we've actually gone somewhere with just me and her, for, you know, a serious amount of time. because unfortunately, you know, life gets in the way and bills, et cetera, et cetera. I won't get into the specifics, but we've just been very busy with life. And I want to make sure that I make time to, you know, spend time with her away from Charlotte. And we're planning on going down to Savannah, Georgia this year. So won't be able to make that star party this year, but perhaps I could make it to the 42nd annual one in 2025. As far as making it out to Australia to see Ryder, I understand, you know, Milky Way season for them should be their summertime, which is our wintertime, obviously, since they're in the southern hemisphere. So I'd more than likely, you know, if you're traveling to the southern hemisphere from the northern hemisphere, you would want to go, you know, December, January, February, somewhere in that range. If you want to, you know, get the core of the Milky Way and see all the cool stuff. I think that's when the large and small Magellanic clouds are out as well, which is obviously something I would really like to see. I think there's even something called the Southern Pleiades in the Southern Hemisphere, which I would really like to see. I don't know if it's quite as breathtaking as our Pleiades, but I would still love to see it, as well as the Southern Cross, obviously, which is something that I've heard about many times, but never seen with my own two eyes. So just another big giant shout out to Ryder. Definitely hope to have him on the show soon. He actually, I know I mentioned he sells his work. He's actually in a gallery too in his local town where he sells his work and has been quite successful selling it. So again, his company name is Knight Ryder Astrophotography, and that is a Knight, like N-I-G-H-T. And then Ryder's R-Y-D-E-R. And I will include the link for his stuff in the show notes. So shout out to you, Ryder. Good luck with purchasing that Bortle 1 land. And don't be surprised when I take you up on that offer, man. I will be coming down under and setting up my scope with you. So if and when I do that, I will have to plan on bringing a very travel-friendly telescope with me, which is something that I was discussing with my friend last night when we were looking up at the stars. So what do you bring with you if you're going for a long flight? And obviously there are weight restrictions and you want to bring, you know, a mount of some kind, and you want to bring either a camera lens and a camera, or maybe a small telescope and an astrophotography camera. So you can make sure that you're able to get quality images. And I was thinking about this last night because, you know, I was talking to my buddy Chris, because I was saying, you know, if I end up going, you know, certainly I'd like if he could come too, because that's one of his dreams, is to be able to see the southern skies as well. And his first reaction was, well, we bring everything. If we're going to Australia, we got to bring everything. And I said, not so fast. We might not be able to bring everything, because there is a limit for carry-on luggage as far as, you know, how much you're allowed to carry on and what that can weigh. And then I don't know how many of you guys have traveled, you know, internationally before, but I personally would not trust putting any of my photography gear, let alone astrophotography gear, in a checked bag that goes under the plane. You know, anytime you're doing transfers between planes, and the way that the bags just get completely manhandled and tossed, you know, no fault to the workers. They're just doing their jobs and they got to quickly toss these bags, and they aren't just anticipating clothes and, you know, shampoo being in those bags. So they're not thinking about telescopes and, you know, delicate visual instruments being on board. So if you're going to be traveling with camera gear, you need to have it on your person. So, and I mean for the entire time. So this is something that you need to keep in mind if you're making an international flight. So I started thinking about it and I said to myself, what would I bring with me if I could only, you know, bring what I could carry on the flight? So I was looking around and I thought, you know, I definitely would want more than just like, you know, my mirrorless camera and a wide angle lens, because, you know, as beautiful as the Milky Way is, I would want to be able to do some deep sky photography of the various targets that are in the southern hemisphere, because, you know, those are the things that I'll never get a chance to do up north. Not to say, you know, that the Milky Way down south, obviously I don't get a chance at that either. But I definitely would want the option to do both. So I think ultimately what I would do is I would likely try to pack down the Star Adventure GTI. I would likely not pack the counterweights, and I'll explain why. So I would, you know, pack down the actual mount head. I would take the tripod, and that I think I would feel comfortable enough putting in my stowaway luggage that goes under the plane. Not the end of the world if I lose the tripod. I could replace a tripod when I get there if I had to. And it wouldn't cost, you know, a fortune, like where if, you know, I lost the astrophotography mount, you know, I can replace a tripod, not that big of a deal. So that takes up a lot of room though, and it's also a lot of weight. So let's put the tripod in the stowaway bag. Let's put the mount head in our carry-on. And then I'm thinking I wouldn't want to just bring my current lens, which is a Rokinon 135. I do like the 135, but I am still coming to grips with it. And I don't know if it's that I have a bad copy of the lens, or perhaps I'm still struggling with the back focus a little bit. I do have an L-Pro filter that I use with it, and I know it's a very fast lens at F2. So perhaps some of my issues are because of that filter not working with such a fast lens. I'm actually, next time I set it up, I'm going to remove the filter entirely and see how or if that improves the image quality. But ultimately, I think something like a Red Cat would be the ideal way to go. You know, a very high quality, small refractor, something with a real wide field of view. You know, I'm pretty sure they have a Red Cat that's like around 400 millimeters in focal length. I don't know if that's the Red Cat 61, I believe. Here, let me check real quick. Okay, so it's actually 300 millimeters at f4.9. So a little bit wider than 400, but still, you know, more than double the Rokinon lens focal length. So plenty of length to reach out and touch the larger nebula. So, you know, things like those Magellanic clouds that I want to be able to get a good look at, and other large targets that are in the sky, I'm going to be able to see. Another huge advantage is it's a very, you know, lightweight telescope. It's only 5.43 pounds. So weight is obviously something that we're going to contend with. And what I was saying earlier about not bringing the counterweights, we can use anything for counterweights. You know, in a pinch, you can use rocks for counterweights. So I wouldn't bring the counterweights. I would just use duct tape and whatever I need to use when I get there. Maybe I could even borrow a counterweight from my buddy Ryder, since he is also an astrophotographer. He could likely, you know, lend me something like that. And in fact, if you are, you know, traveling to another country or far away, and you're lucky enough to have a friend there who also does astronomy, these are the kind of discussions that you want to have well in advance, because planning is going to be of the utmost importance when you're making a trip like this. The more that you can plan ahead, the better results you're going to have to take home. For example, the first time that we made our annual dark sky trip that me and my buddy that I've mentioned many times before and will certainly mention again, make each year. You know, I look back on that first trip and realize that there were, you know, several mistakes that we made, and we were there for 3 nights. You know, it wasn't like we were just there for one night, but there were a lot of little things that we could have done better. You know, when we were setting up, while we were imaging, I forgot to get foreground shots while I was doing, my wide field Milky Way stuff. I was still, you know, relatively new to astrophotography. I wasn't like brand new by any means. I was, you know, fairly experienced, but I wasn't, you know, as knowledgeable as I am today. But I should have known better to get a foreground shot, but I was super excited. I saw the Milky Way and my, you know, my jaw was on the ground. So I was just taking pictures and like, wow, look how pretty this is. So, you know, a good idea if you were to do something like this would be to get a notebook and start jotting down your ideas well in advance. Another cool thing about that is it would give you something fun to look forward to as you're, you know, if you're planning a trip like this, it's obviously going to be something that you probably are planning well in advance. For example, if I were to go to Australia, that's the kind of thing I would probably plan at least a year in advance. So that would give me something I could work on while I'm waiting for that trip to come around. If I've got, you know, a notebook, I can keep notes, you know, as I'm setting up my gear. If something occurs to me that will, you know, work better for me while I'm out in the field, you know, whether it be battery related or mount related or gear related, take notes on it. So that way, whenever the trip actually comes and you're going to be out in the field working, you don't run into little problems and you remember to do the little things like take the foreground shots or don't pack the counterweights because you can use rocks and duct tape when you get there. And I know that sounds silly, but you can literally use rocks and duct tape in a pinch if you need to. So we would pack the mount head. We would definitely go with something like a Red Cat. And then I would probably bring my Canon R7 along with two lenses, I'm thinking, because I'm also a wildlife photographer and I would be in Australia. I would be crazy not to bring a telephoto lens. So I would probably bring like my RF 100-400, which is just a phenomenal budget-friendly photographer's lens. It's f5.6-8, which is not a super fast lens, but it's only $599, which by, you know, modern photography standards is very inexpensive for a telephoto lens of that range. And the quality is outstanding. I've gotten some of my best photos with that lens. So I would definitely want to bring that. Luckily, it folds down pretty small whenever it's not zoomed out all the way. And then I would likely bring something like a 16 millimeter wide angle lens for getting Milky Way shots. And then a simple, like a three-legged thing or a Joby Gorillapod type tripod. So just a small bendable, I can put it on the ground or hang it off of a branch type tripod where I can use it to get wide field Milky Way shots. So, you know, if I've got a mount head, Astro camera, real camera, couple lenses, and a Red Cat, I can pack all that down in to a single carry-on luggage that fits in the overhead bin. And then you're allowed to have one other carry-on item, which for me is usually a book bag or a duffel bag. And then I can put all my other absolute necessities in there, like medications, passport, money, you know, the stuff that you have to have, you put in there. And then all the other stuff that, you know, if absolutely need be, can be replaced when you get there. That's what you put in your big luggage that goes underneath the plane. Because what you don't want to happen is to get halfway around the world for your trip only to find out that you do not have the gear that you came halfway around the world to use. Because there is nothing that could be more disappointing than for that to happen. Speaking of William Optics, we just talked about their Red Cat. I wanted to quickly touch on a new refractor telescope that they recently released. They actually released two of them in two different sizes. It's the Pleiades line of septuplet APO refractors. These are just incredibly beautiful telescopes. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to look at them. They're very expensive. They're back ordered pretty much everywhere. It looks like they sold out almost instantly everywhere. And they are very fast for refractors. So they come in at f4.8 and it's a 111 millimeter refractor. So f4.8 with 111 millimeter. It's a beast of a refractor. There's no doubt about that. But just looking over the photos, and I've watched a couple of review videos as well, it's kind of looking like my dream refractor. So if I had the money, it's, you know, $3,800 for this, which is way outside of my budget right now. You know, they do have the other version as well, which is a shorter focal length. That is the Pleiades 68, and it is equally beautiful and looks to be just as well made. Also a septuplet APO refractor. Man, just I'm looking at the photos right now and I just, oh man, I got gear envy so bad. It's actually got a picture of the Pleiades asterism painted or anodized, I should say, on the black finish. And then it's blue, just like the, you know, the blue emission nebula of the Pleiades. And let's see, that one's actually faster. It's a 68 millimeter apochromatic refractor. So it's actually faster at F3.8, but it's 260 millimeters on the focal length. So, you know, significantly wider focal length. I don't know that I would, I don't know if I could find myself paying $2,000 for a telescope with a 260 millimeter focal length. You know, that's just me personally. I don't know how many targets line up well at that focal length. I feel like the 400 to 600 millimeter focal length is a better kind of catch-all for a telescope. I know that there are larger targets like, you know, Ro fits really great. And the 135, like the Rokinon, one of the best parts about getting that lens was the fact that I could get Ro Ophiuchi Nebula entirely in the frame and actually kind of perfectly in the frame with that lens. But it would be, you know, at 260 millimeters, Ro, I think would be beautiful in this telescope, actually. It would just be a little, you know, probably twice the size, honestly, looking at it. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Let me know if you get a chance. You know, shoot me a message on Twitter or X, as they call it, or feel free to email me a message and let me know what you think of these new Pleiades telescopes. I personally think they're beautiful. I see why they're charging a little bit more money than the other typical refractors in this arena. But, you know, I don't know, $2,000 or 260 millimeters. I don't know about that, because I was just looking at that Red Cat that had a similar focal length, and it was, what was it, like $1,200, I believe. So I don't know. It's definitely a big ask, but a very, very nice, well-made telescope. The bigger one, though, at, you know, $3,700, that's the kind of dream telescope that I could definitely see myself buying if I, you know, won the astrophotography lottery and somebody was like, you know, I just have to send you this for review and you're welcome to keep it. I would certainly be on board with that. But man, I wonder what that thing weighs. Let's find out. Wow. Okay. It's only 17 pounds. That's kind of surprising. I thought it was going to be significantly heavier than that, considering it has seven elements inside of it. I thought it would be more like 25 pounds, but yeah, 17 pounds. That's not bad at all. So something like an AM5 could certainly run this. So, yeah, check that out, though. William Optics Pleiades 111. If you are a very well off astrophotographer and you maybe got a connection to somebody because they're back ordered everywhere, perhaps you might want to look at purchasing one of those. And if you do, take some photos of it and please email them to me, because I definitely would like to see the results. Let's do a quick recommendation. I didn't give what I would consider to be a true recommendation last week, because my recommendation was more of just a target in the sky that I thought was interesting for the week, which was the comet that we discussed earlier in today's episode. But my recommendation this week is actually going to be an app. It's available on both iOS and Android. One of the questions that I see frequently asked online is, you know, what's a good app for finding various targets? And, you know, for when you're at your desktop computer, Stellarium personally is my absolute favorite. I love using Stellarium for a multitude of reasons. However, with that being said, when I am out in the field, or, you know, just in my front yard even, and I am, you know, wanting to know what a particular star is or trying to find an interesting target, and I want to see, you know, what part of my sky is free by lining it up with what's available in the sky. There is one app that I always seem to fall back on, and that is going to be Sky Safari Pro in my case. There is a regular Sky Safari as well. I think the Pro version's paid, and it ranges in price. I think you can get it from, you know, $15 to $25, depending on if you get it on sale or what have you. I think they're up to version 7 now. I paid for Sky Safari Pro 6 on Android a couple of years ago, and then I went over to iOS, and I had to pay for it again. And then I came back to Android, so I'm just sticking with 6 because, honestly, it's got all the functionality that I need. But it's a really great app. It's got, you know, pretty much all of the major deep sky objects you could want. As far as all of the major nebulae, they all exist within the app, and you can see them just by zooming in on the target. Certain things aren't always there, like the Sharpless catalog. It does list the Sharpless catalog, so you can see, you know, where it is in the night sky, but it might not actually paint the target for you. Like, for example, the Dolphin Head Nebula, you can find it in Sky Safari, but it won't actually show you a picture of the Dolphin Head Nebula. But it'll show you where it is in the night sky. And I really love using it with a compass feature. I know cell phone compasses aren't super accurate, but it's very good to use if you have a bright star in the vicinity of what you're looking for. You can hold your phone up and then kind of match up what you're seeing on screen to that bright star and then get a good idea of where your target is at. I use this all the time whenever I'm looking for something, you know, interesting to find in the night sky. And I personally find it to be an invaluable tool. We used it last night whenever we were searching for that comet that I was, you know, having trouble finding because the ASI Air software was incorrectly reporting where that comet was. It's got some advanced features too. You can actually control your telescope with it, believe it or not. When I got my first telescope, which I mentioned, I believe, in our first episode, the Celestron Astrofy 130, you can actually connect, you know, telescopes directly to it and control, and it'll do things like a three-star alignment and go to as well. So if you want to use those more advanced functions, you can absolutely do that. You can simulate what time it is, which obviously is a crucial function if you're, you know, hanging out during the day and you're saying to yourself, like, well, what do I want to look at tonight? You can just, you know, quickly move over to tonight. One of the things that I like to do is look months in advance. You know, if I'm like bored in March and I'm, you know, daydreaming of how awesome it's going to be in July when all the nebula are up, I'll skip ahead a few months and then just kind of look through what's going to be in the night sky come July and, you know, try to pick out targets. So Sky Safari Pro, like I said, it's available on iOS and Android. They have a free version that's very great. I personally love the Pro version because it comes with more items in the catalogs and a few extra features that are really great. It's got an awesome Tonight's Best chart in it that's really cool. It'll tell you things like when the ISS is going to rise and even if like the Hubble telescope, if it's coming by, it'll tell you, you know, the best deep sky objects that are out at any given time and those sorts of things. So definitely check that out if you haven't before. I know there are a million different astronomy applications on the, you know, iOS and App Store for Android. But personally, I like Sky Safari the best, and I've used pretty much all of them. So I've got a little bit of authority to speak on that because I have used pretty much all of them over the years. So definitely check out Sky Safari Pro if you get a chance to. Also, one thing I wanted to do was give a quick shout out to one of our favorite followers. That is Three Sisters Astronomy. If you want to look them up on Instagram, that is the number three, then Sisters Astronomy spelled out. They have some awesome work. In particular, I'm a big fan of their Milky Way shots. And then their version of Thor's helmet is just incredible. Very, very good detail on that, ladies. You put my version to absolute shame. So keep up the great work on that. Go check them out on Instagram. That's Three Sisters Astronomy. And finally, one other big announcement for this week. We have actually launched a Patreon for the podcast. So what we would like to do if we do get any subscribers is have a monthly meetup where we'll have you know, one-on-one sessions in a private Discord where we can get together and talk all things astronomy. And then obviously we'll do some things like exclusive episodes and those sorts of things. But I would really like for us all to be able to get together and have, you know, one-on-one talk time once a month where everybody can get together who enjoys astronomy and astrophotography and just have a cool place to get together and talk as friends and, you know, fellow lovers of astronomy. So if you would like to check that out, that is patreon.com/theastrocast. And I believe it's at like $5 a month to become a member. That's the only tier that I have right now. I might look at lower tiers and higher tiers at some point in the future. I just figured for starting out, that's not a bad idea. I might go with something lower, like $1 a month just to get started, because I realize $5 a month is a lot. But if you are a big fan of the show and you would like to show support, that is an excellent way to do it. Just to be fully give full disclosure, what I plan on doing with any money that we get would just be to advertise the show so we can bring in more listeners. So, you know, if I get four members that join the Patreon a month, then that'll be $20 that goes into, you know, Google advertising, so we can bring in more listeners and spread the word of the Astrocast so more people can hear. So all I want to do is bring in more lovers of astronomy and astrophotography so more people can hear every week. And that's pretty much the only goal. So if we end up getting a lot more members, then obviously we can revisit those goals at some point. But for now, that is our number one goal with the Patreon. And I will definitely make sure that I make it worth anyone's while that chooses to support the show financially. So I just want to thank all of you guys so much for taking the time out of your day to listen to these episodes. I've gotten so much awesome feedback already. We are on episode 9. We're quickly closing in on our 10th episode. I can't believe we're almost there already. It feels like a long time, honestly, since we started the show. Usually people say when they get to their, you know, 10th episode that it went by in the blink of an eye. But I feel like I've been doing this for a while with you guys now, and I love it. So that's a really great feeling. And just want to thank you guys so much for tuning in and listening. There is a particular person I also want to mention before we close out this week's show that you may or may not know about if you are big into astronomy. And if you don't know about this person, I would recommend that you check out a book that I have recommended in the past. That is by Dr. Emily Levesque, and it is called The Last Stargazers. But I am not referring to Dr. Levesque. The person that I am referring to is one Henrietta Leavitt. So she was actually an American astronomer way back in the day. She was born in 1868 and she died in 1921. And what Miss Leavitt did completely changed our understanding of the nature of the universe. Just so you know, what her discovery led to provided basically the first standard candle, which is used to measure the distance to other galaxies. So what she did was she found a correlation between luminosity and the period of Cepheid variable stars. And by measuring the luminosity of these Cepheid variables at various times throughout the year, she was able to calculate distances to stars accurately and galaxies accurately for the first time, which was just an incredible feat that nobody thought she was capable of. She was actually tasked with being a human computer at Harvard back in a time when women were relegated to not even do what you would call real astronomy. And she ended up completely blowing the doors off the astronomical world. To me, she is one of the very first rock star astronomers and an absolute hero of mine. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Henrietta Swan Leavitt. May she rest in peace. Her discovery of Cepheid variables, luminosity, and how that relates to the measuring of distances to galaxies cannot be understated. It completely changed the way that we understand the universe. And the way she did that was through parallax techniques and triangulation. So basically, if you take the Earth and put it in space at two different points. So, you know, let's say it's going around the sun, right? And we're in one spot in space in spring, And then we're in another spot in space in fall, and we're looking at the same star, and we measure that brightness, and it's different between, you know, the brightness is different depending on if it's spring or fall. She was able to use the difference in the brightness to calculate the distance. And that is what led to the standard candle measurement for galaxies, stars, etc. So again, she's an absolute rock star. She's awesome. And she came up in conversation a couple weeks ago when I was out to dinner with a friend. And I just wanted to mention her in our podcast because she is worth mentioning for sure. So just figured I would kind of end with that. She quite literally was the first person to accurately measure the distance to another galaxy. So with all that being said, what else can be said? Henrietta Leavitt, absolute rock star. I want to thank you guys so much for tuning into the Astrocast this week. I know this was a little bit of a weird episode, kind of all over the place. I just wanted to sit down and talk astro with you guys for a little bit this week. And that's what I did. And that's okay. It's all right. You know, just sit down and have a little bit of fun every once in a while. And we don't always have to stay hard on one topic. We'll be back to a more traditional episode next week, but I thought it would be cool to just kind of sit down and, you know, talk shop for a week. So that's what we did, and we'll be back next week with another episode of the Astrocast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Rue. I hope you have a wonderful week. Enjoy the new moon. I really hope there aren't any clouds around for it. Clear skies. We'll see you next week. So it's another recommendation ye seek. Hey, matey. I don't know what I just did there. I was trying to go for a Captain from the Simpsons vibe. If you guys haven't read Shogun by James Clavell, now is the time to read it. I read this book when I was 18, and it kind of changed my life. It did change my life. And when I read it, I was super happy to learn that there was a show for Shogun. But unfortunately for me, it was made in the 70s and it was kind of campy. And I mean, they did the best that they could for what they had at the time. And I mean, it was good for what it was, but it just left something to be desired. Well, lucky for us, we're in this golden age of streaming and they have finally done justice to Shogun and remade it. And Hulu is currently on the third episode right now of Shogun. But if you haven't read the book, it's a big book. And when I say big book, I mean like 1700 pages big. But it is a very good read. It will change the way that you think about life. If you're inclined to read such a book, I would highly recommend it. There is an excellent version on Audible. If audiobooks are your thing, check that out. If you don't want to read anything at all, then at least go check out the show on Hulu. Highly recommend that. But at least watch the Japanese version. Please don't turn on the subtitles. Normally, I'm a dubs guy. Or I'm sorry, leave the subtitles on. Don't turn on the dubs. Whatever you do, don't turn on the dubs. It's meant to be appreciated in Japanese. It's kind of the whole point of the story. So there is English in it, though. Don't worry. One of the main characters speaks English, and a lot of the other characters do as well. So Shogun, go check that one out. You won't be disappointed. Peace.